Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me here today to speak. We'll be talking about our project here and looking at shale gas wells positioned close to longwall mining. This is a ground control and ventilation project. Dr. Daniel Hsu is the principal investigator, and this is, there are 1,500 wells in place or anticipated over the next 10 to 15 years that will be affected by longwall mining. So this isn't a hypothetical case, this is reality. I'll touch on our problem statement. These are the, this is the material I'll be covering today, and we should be addressing each of these topics as we move through. So for our problem statement, the question arose, we have shale gas wells positioned in pillars next to longwall mines, and the pillar is designed to be protection for these wells from ground movement, for stability of these wells. And the question that came about is, could there be some combination of events that could compromise the integrity of these wells? And these diagrams on this slide show you a few different configurations. So this is Northern Appalachian Basin, and these are primarily Pittsburgh coal bed mines. And so we're showing a few different well pads here in abutment pillars, and also one in a barrier pillar. So what's the need for research on this subject? Well, the starting point was this 1957 PADEP gas pillar guidance that was published. Of course, that predates longwall mining in the United States. So that was updated in 2017 with what's known as a technical guidance document. So that's in place now, but that was really intended as essentially an interim document, and really it was anticipated that a much larger and more complete guidance was needed, and that's what we're working towards. We are working with a group of stakeholders, regulatory agencies, industry people. So it's a large group in this coal gas work group, and we provide scientific input to that. So some of the issues here that are important to this this overall question are shown. So obviously we have deformation associated with mining that produces induced fracturing, and those fractures then would be the transport network if you would have a breach of a hypothetical breach of one of these wells. So if you had an incursion to a mine operation, what would happen? How could you detect that it had occurred, and potentially can we distinguish coal bed methane from these non-coal sources if it were to occur? So these gas wells then are protected by these pillars as we mentioned. So could there be some sort of combination of events that could compromise these wells? Our ground control research partners do very sophisticated analysis for movement of these wells and the stresses that they're under, but again, a worst case scenario. So what we're talking about today is the ventilation side of this project. So these are basically the pieces of the ventilation research that we were conducting. So there is a portion of our work that estimates what an inflow, a hypothetical inflow, would be to the mine workings. And So you can see some of those tasks there. We have modeling done to simulate transport of that gas through the mine workings, through the ventilation system. And then we have a third overall task looking at distinguishing gas sources again. If we had something from the shale gas well and there's an additional source reaching the mine, could we identify it? So for the experimental data, a portion of our experimental data is done to determine permeabilities. As we said, the induced fracture network would form the transport network for breach gas moving away from the well. So we have identified here in the Northern Appalachian Basin three different depth categories. And so the deepest is over 900 feet, the shallowest is under 500 feet, and then there's an intermediate category. So we have field sites where we gather experimental data on measured permeabilities for these scenarios over abutment builders. So right now we have shallow and deep cover, and we're in the process of negotiating for an intermediate cover site. And the diagram there shows one of our monitoring sites. So these are configured to look like one of these well pads for an unconventional well pad. So those are our that's a monitoring array that we have that we use. That was actually a shallow cover site, and each of those wells then is monitoring a different horizon for permeability. So one of the first questions we had was, over these abutment pillars, when a long wall goes by, does it modify permeability? It does. So this plot we're showing here is changing permeability with face position over time, and these are our two coal bed units of interest. So that they were showing permeability for the Sewickley and Uniontown coal beds, and so we're reaching a maximum there for the Sewickley of about 17.5 millidarcies here. As the face goes by, that's the maximum value we've reached. So it absolutely does change. It changes with face position. And then there's other values there also shown for the Uniontown. This particular plot is showing long-term permeability monitoring, and I guess one of the other key features I would mention is that over time, this site has been active now for almost a year. Long-term monitoring permeability comes back down to initial permeability levels, pre-mining permeability levels. So an important parameter in the fracture permeability for these sites is overburden depth. And so what we're showing here are two of our sites, our deep cover and shallow cover site. So on the left, you can see permeability values for the deep cover site. This was the Uniontown horizon, and it reaches up to a value of a little over 5 millidarcies. And then at the right, on the right, is our shallow cover site. Same horizon, same Uniontown, and there you have a maximum value of a little under 250 millidarcies. So almost, so two orders of magnitude difference for those two depth intervals. Also, we're not showing it on this plot, but as we showed, these sites on, in abutment pillars are actually mined by on both sides, and so the highest permeabilities are generally experienced in second panel mining. So, and the last bullet point there is just mentioning that we've seen the level of increase about 1.5 to 3 times increase from first panel to second panel mining. So another important parameter here is topography. We have one of our sites actually was located near a stream channel, one of our permeability monitoring sites. And so on the left side, we see a more typical Pittsburgh topography, southwestern Pennsylvania topography permeability plot. And in 2 to 3 months of monitoring, we see the permeabilities have dropped down to about 10 to 15% of the maximum value. In this case, it's about 10%. For the Stream Valley site, the permeability values stayed high, and they remain at about 90% of the maximum value here as mining proceeds for that 2 to 3 month monitoring period. Another important parameter is the position of the maximum zone of horizontal movement. This value comes to us from our ground control research partners. So where, that is where we assume the hypothetical breach is occurring. And so if that zone of maximum movement is more than 300 feet above the mine coal bed, in this case a Pittsburgh coal bed, then that's above the induced fracturing that occurs in the gob. It's very difficult then for that any breach gas to reach down, migrate down to the mine workings. So, so in that sense, it's a very important parameter to what the mine, mine would potentially see. So these are two sites, intermediate cover sites, and we're showing what the estimated inflow values there would be. So they're low, very low to zero. And that is, again, that influence of where that maximum zone of movement occurs. So in mentioning these, you know, we're admittedly, each of these topics is essentially a paper in its own right. So I just want to mention a little bit about the individual tasks that are producing this data. So there are two DFN models that we use to produce these inflow estimates. So on the left is the DFN 3-deck modeling is used to produce fracture apertures based on a starting fracture aperture and then modified by ground movement to produce a permeability map of the overburden. And then on the right, we use a second DFN model. The FFC model uses the output to produce 100 realizations, two-dimensional realizations for fracture patterns in the gob. And from those fracture maps, then we produce inflow estimates to the model. So we can summarize then what we've done so far in terms of estimating what these hypothetical inflows would be to a mine. So that's summarized in this word slide. It might be really that's all captured in this next slide. Maybe this is a better way to view it. So here are three depth categories. The shallow, intermediate, and deep cover sites. And this is a summary of our results to date. So for the shallow cover site, there's only been one that's kind of an enhanced transport scenario. It was a stream valley site, and the maximum zone of movement was within the fracture zone. So that's kind of an enhanced transport scenario. So that we have fairly high values estimated for a potential inflow to a mine. For the intermediate cover site, we had touched on this earlier. Those are the values that for the inflow estimates, again, all the maximum zone of movement was above the fracture zone. And for the deep cover site, we had all those inflow estimates were zero, except for one site where we had movement within the fracture zone, and that produced that 44 CFM value. So that slide essentially summarizes where we are. So then we're kind of following the gas movement here away from a potential well breach towards the mine, and now moving in the ventilation network of the mine. So if you have inflow quantities that don't exceed about 400 CFM, our simulations here have shown that the mine standard ventilation scenarios, or those used here in these Pittsburgh coal mines, there is a good chance they could potentially handle that additional amount of gas. That's what we're mentioning here. So they did show, these ventilation systems did show good potential for diluting that additional gas. And these simulations showed that at these critical locations, the bleeder evaluation points and the bleeders, those added gas, that added gas was below statutory limits. And there was no gas on the face. And we'll show you a little bit more about that. We did another hypothetical scenario with, again, this is hypothetical, but if you had a breach of up to around 2100 CFM, at that level, then we found that the ventilation system would be challenged. Some of those statutory kinds of locations, the BEPs and the bleeders, they could be above concentrations, could be above acceptable levels. So in that, a volume of that level, that quantity of flow reached the mine, that could be problematic, and some other additional actions might need to follow. So we use, we've been using two tools to do this assessment of gas transport and ventilation networks. So on the top of that slide, we're doing some network ventilation models. So this is a vent sim image, and this is one of the sites we produced simulations for. So on the bottom portion of that portion of the slide is the active panel, and the orange there shows the distance to the assumed breach location, and then gas moving through fractures into the mine. And you can see the plume moving towards the back of the panel, back of the inactive panel adjacent to it. And on the table and the image to the bottom shows our work with our physical model. Some of you may be aware of our longwall instrumented aerodynamic model. We can do ventilation experiments on the Liam. And we can introduce a dilute tracer gas to produce estimates of the increase in concentration that we produce from one of these breaches. And that's what we're showing there in the table. And as we mentioned, essentially acceptable or manageable levels of methane increases, and no gas again on the face. And we have good agreements between the differing methods. The last topic here is this idea about a method to distinguish non-coal sources from coal bed methane. Such a technology exists. I mean, you can do stable isotope analysis, but for this application, there are concerns. This would be something that potentially could be integrated with mining, mine face approaching one of these wells. So something that would be more amenable to more frequent sampling, faster turnaround time would be potentially better for the industry. So we have been exploring a gas chromatography-based method, and those results here are summarized. But I think the next plot probably covers that pretty well. So these are data from we've been using and showing here for a little while now. So we've been using these bivariate plots, these graphs, to distinguish these gas sources. So you have shale gas there, shown by those light blue triangles, coal bed methane by the orange circles, and underground storage field gas is another potential source in this area, and those are shown by those dark squares. So here is how we've been plotting these. So on the horizontal axis there on the left is what's known as the hydrocarbon index. It's basically methane over C2 plus C3, and carbon dioxide concentrations on the vertical axis. So we've been able to show pretty good distinguishment of these three groups, and they occupy different portions of these plots. On the right is the same data, plotted just differently. On the vertical axis now is the methane to carbon dioxide ratio. And again, we think we have good distinguishment of these three groups to potentially, again, identify a non-coal source if there would be one in near one of these mines. We've been working towards with some of our research partners and cooperators. We've been working towards expanding this database. So we have an agreement with CNX, and they have allowed us to sample some of their wells. So these are shale gas wells and CBM wells. We don't have any underground storage field data here for these sites, but these are additional data then towards this goal of having a statistical viable method that would be accepted by our group of stakeholders. And this is what that data looks like. Again, we are happy with the distinguishment of those two groups and how it relates to our original data set. So this is our effort to expand our data towards this goal. So for takeaway points, again, too many words here, but these are the topics I think we started out with. And so I think we touched on all of these. So overburden depth is very important to permeability. And again, we saw this two orders of magnitude difference between shallow and deep cover. The impact of topography, it's very important. These stream valley locations produce enhanced transport through the fracture system and potentially towards a mine. And more typical topography that we would have in this region showed some very different behavior. Again, we talked about the importance of where this zone is, where this horizon is, where you have your maximum zone of movement. So within that fractured zone, for reduced fractures associated with the gob or above it, that's a critical piece of information. We've summarized our hypothetical inflow findings, and hopefully gave you an idea how we acquire those estimates. And then we talked about transport of the gas in the underground mines ventilation system. So that 340 to 400 CFM threshold looks like something that could be manageable from what we've done so far. And then we summarized our this method we've been working on to distinguish gas sources. That's all I had. So we have a big team. All the folks on the right here have gone to produce the information that you saw here today. And the rest of our team on the left, we're very fortunate to have this group of people working on this project, and happy to have try and answer any questions.
Great talk. Thanks. A quick question for you: would you be recommending that mine operators consider increasing their ventilation systems and make it more robust for this potential if there are these deep wells close in proximity?
I don't think we would necessarily say that. I think what we would, we would certainly recommend that we identify, and I think the regulatory folks already do that, identify these periods when the face is coming near one of these wells and going by one, and then maybe additional monitoring, and I think that's already there in that TGD and the technical guidance document that's in place now. But you could potentially maybe do some of that gas source analysis near the well or underground. You could do some additional precautionary things.
I appreciate the accommodation. Hey, Steve, I thought that was a really good presentation, and is one of the members of the work group, we really appreciate what NIOSH is doing, taking the lead on the research. The question I have with respect to the values that you're presenting, just for my own clarification, you've provided a couple hypothetical volumes of gas for the inflow. Now, what would the effect be if the hypothetical breach was closer? So we're getting a lot of permeability data presented for the Uniontown and Swickley, but in a lot of test wells, we're finding deformations occurring near the seam location. So instead of being several hundred feet away, it might be 20 or 30 feet away from the seam. Could you comment on the impact of that on the hypothetical volumes we're talking about?
Thanks, Greg. One of those values is exactly that scenario. So that deep cover scenario where we had a small inflow estimated, so most of these deep cover scenarios we haven't seen anything. It was very close, but again, you go back to these, sort of the ground control side of the project, how much movement do we see there? So is there enough to actually even be seen by the well? So if you have some movement and then all these multiple casings that are there to protect the well, if this aspect of cementing or not cementing a well, so I guess that would be my first question is there enough there, and is the well designed such that it sees any of that movement? But in that one case, we did see some. Hopefully I answered that.
Okay. Do you want to turn your attention to Trona now?
Sure.